Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Humanities Foundation, co-sponsored by the Departments of English, Romance Studies, and Modern Languages and Comparative Literature. Our speaker is Yale University Sterling Professor of Theater and English, Joseph Roach. Professor Roach's lecture is titled New Poetics, Performance Studies, and the Research University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Associate Professor Carrie Preston.
Joseph Roach does it, to borrow the title of his most recent monograph, It. And he does it as a stage director, teacher, theater historian, and founder of the field we now call performance studies. His career serves as a good reminder of the many ways we might do it. He fused scholarship and creative productions with important administrative stints, including chairmanships at Washington University, Northwestern, NYU, all before his current position as the Sterling Professor of English and Theater and Director of Interdisciplinary Performance Studies at Yale University. He advocates a performance-based pedagogy in which doing, thinking, and writing are integrated into one activity. Roach's first book, The Player's Passion, Studies in the Science of Acting, won the Barnard Hewitt Award in Theater History and emerged from his experience teaching acting at Sweetbriar College in Virginia. He connects ideas and debates in the history of the life sciences with theories of acting from the 17th through the 20th centuries. Interdisciplinary, before that term became a buzzword, The Player's Passion also turned attention to that frequently degraded, often embarrassingly egotistical figure, the actor, and the processes by which performance methods and any other forms of knowledge are transmitted through embodied practices clarified by the life sciences. In his second book, Cities of the Dead, Circum-Atlantic Performance, which was published in 1996, Roach anticipated another buzzword, transatlantic studies. The book won the James Russell Lowell Prize from MLA and the Callaway Prize from NYU. Roach examined several genres of performance as memorials to the circulation of cultures, material and symbolic, in a circumatlantic vortex. He studies the intersection of geographical and sociocultural forces that, he argues, produce culture. He defines culture as a social process of memory and forgetting carried out in performance events including plays, rites, carnivals, slave trades, and the rituals of everyday life. Culture reproduces and recreates itself through surrogation, and performance is the process of trying out different candidates or understudies to replace the originals, he argues. So the bamboulas, or dance frenzies, in New Orleans' Congo Square replace the slave auction. Carnival becomes a surrogate for carnage. For Roach, circumatlantic studies offered a way out of a canon organized around national borders and imagined divisions to turn our focus to historic relationships and encounters. And in It, published in 2007, Roach continues to study the way time percolates, as he calls it, rather than flows, so that we live in and with the consequences of the past. It is that easily recognized but difficult to define quality possessed by abnormally interesting people. Breaking period and disciplinary bounds, as usual, Roach traces it to the deep 18th century, when celebrities began to circulate as images in the manner of religious and regal icons. As what Roach calls secular magic, it includes manifestations of public intimacy or the quality of seeming availability. It offers synthetic or vicarious experience and personality-driven mass attraction. Roach is the recipient of the Lifetime Distinguished Scholar Award from the American Society for Theater Research and a Distinguished Achievement Award from the Andrew Mellon Foundation. For anyone like myself interested in performance and theater studies, Roach is it, even a celebrity. Roach wrote of celebrities doubting Thomas effect in It and a recent PMLA publication, referencing Caravaggio's The Incredulity of St. Thomas, a depiction of Christ drawing the finger of the doubting apostle into the bloodless hole of the stigmata all the way to the second knuckle. Roach argues that fans have such probing fingers as they search for the gaping wounds of their both otherworldly and vulnerably wounded celebrities. If I avoid such intimate authentication of Roach's stature here, I hope you will join me in welcoming him to Boston University's Lectures and Criticism series. This afternoon, he will be sharing his work on New Poetics, Performance Studies, and the Research University. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry, for that wonderful introduction. That was really fine. I so appreciate that detail. It's a pleasure to be here, and I was thrilled to be invited to BU because I've always held it in special esteem because of what I take to be the vibrant arts community and arts training and education programs that exist here in proximity to distinguished College of Arts and Sciences. And it's that possibility and that missed opportunity in higher education that's my subject today. This work that I'm going to be talking about was cast specifically to make the arts a vibrant area of research at Yale, with research outcomes that went beyond the performances in dance, performance art, and theater that we gave. The work was done under the aegis of what we call the World Performance Project at Yale. It was funded by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation through the Distinguished Achievement Award. And it gave me at first 3 and ultimately 6 years total to bring companies to campus, to bring scholars who knew about the work to campus, to generate publications from graduate students, from colleagues, from the experts who were our guests, and to make publication a part of the arts as a continuum based on the model of the sciences, not emulating their systematic methods, but emulating what I take to be their sociability. So our publications, for instance, are signed by a number of us, and the credit is distributed to make it clear that all of us were part of the work that I'm going to tell you about now. The first artist I brought to campus was a friend of mine from New Orleans, John O'Neill. John is a founder of the Free Southern Theater and was a regional field secretary for SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in the day. Some of you here are of my generation will remember those days in the South in the 1960s when there was a crucible in American politics, and the Free Southern Theater toured with a mixed-race company, 1962, 1963, around the Deep South. And John creates a character in his own performance work called Junebug Jabo Jones, and he's a great raconteur and special character, trickster, really. And Junebug's daddy was a preacher man, and Junebug's daddy had some advice for Junebug about what you do when you're talking to a group of people, and it went something like this. Junebug, when you talk to the people, you got to remember 3 things. First, you tell them what you're going to tell them. Second, you tell them. Third, you tell them what you done told them. My talk is in 3 parts. The first and third part, where I tell you what I'm going to tell you when I tell you what I done told you, are short. The middle part, where I tell you, is a little bit longer. And then when you get to the business about my musical theater version of the Orpheus myth called Don't Look Back, the Temptations provided the anthem for our musical, will be about at the end. You might reasonably ask at the outset, what do I think a poetics of performance is? And it's great that we heard in the introduction about the piece in PMLA, because I was in a dust-up in that very issue with my good friend Jonathan Culler, who, by wonderful coincidence, is speaking here on this very day, I guess not right at this hour, but coming up. And I'm glad to plug the talk, even though he really took me to task for that article in PMLA, which was a weird occasion because he was the editor who commissioned it. And then in the introduction, he really took me on. But fair enough, the article Performance, The Blunders of Orpheus proposes what I call an ambient poetics, founded on performance, literary and otherwise, and it recuperates mimesis in the name of the Orphic. It's based on looking back, or at least looking around, in order to move forward. You can't move forward unless you look back first. That's the idea. And Jonathan's introduction objects to what he takes to be my error of confounding the mimetic with the expressive, as if you can't have both. And if any of you are attending that talk, I wish you would ask him this question. How do you get to a theory of the lyric without performance? And also, how do you make hip-hop one of your key examples of the lyric without performance, which he does? So I wish I could be there to put that question myself, but if someone will put it for me and drop my name, I'd be very grateful. I'm really, I've always been interested my whole life as a literary scholar in Eric Auerbach and the idea of the figura, where you're not only looking back but looking forward, is very powerful in my way of thinking about performance. Kathy Carruth is generous in her response in this PMLA issue, and of course more brilliant too. And I'm grateful to be able to say, in understanding Kathy's understanding, that my point that literary criticism of the 21st century, just like literature itself, has to involve more than just reading and writing, though it must continue to involve that, of course. Anyone who wants to go forward to write discursively about performance should be able to look back on prior performances, including preferably the experience of having made performances themselves. Genre doesn't matter, medium doesn't matter, scale doesn't matter. Embodying a poem, memorizing it, and saying it aloud is a performance. A performance that's really important for those of us who teach literature to model for our students. But before performance, rehearsal. As part of this project that I'm talking about, I developed a curriculum that includes dance as an important component, which Yale hadn't taught as an academic subject heretofore. But it also includes oral interpretation of poetry, which I call poetics of performance. And here's my first assignment, listening cultures, ambient poetics, breathing, sound, and meaning. First exercise, extinct sounds. We are losing certain sounds because of our rapidly changing post-industrial environments. Collect a particular sound that you believe is on the verge of extinction. What kinds of cultural and personal meanings have become attached to this sound? What could its impending extinction mean for the world that includes it? How will it be remembered after it is gone? Perform it and do a short description of a paragraph with the performance due in class. I get a lot of Donkey Kong reminiscences, but I also get some amazing things that come about. And I'm glad to share my extinct sound, which is, to me, an embodiment of why it's great to have the arts, the creative and performing arts, actively imbricated within the discursive, academic, text-based, canon-based teaching of literature. The person who has the office across from me is Louise Glick, the poet. And Louise doesn't use computers. She doesn't use email. She won't go near them. She produces her poetry and her correspondence on an old Remington portable typewriter. So the sound that I have across from me is Louise on her typewriter. And the fascinating thing about it, I've listened, and there are various genres in her literary production, and I can tell, at least I think I can tell, what's going on. If she's typing rapidly, and she's an accurate and rapid typist, and I hear the ding of the return along with the clack, 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 clack at that tempo, I know she's telling off an editor, dumping a boyfriend, something that requires rapid-fire correspondence. But then, when I hear a cadence like click, 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 I know that another kind of writing is happening in that room. The kind of writing that you have in Dedication to Hunger, if you know Louise's work, a soul-searing memoir of anorexia. It begins quietly in certain female children, the fear of death taking as its form dedication to hunger. Because a woman's body is a grave, it will accept anything. I remember lying in bed at night, touching the soft, digressive breasts, touching, at 15, the interfering flesh that I would sacrifice until the limbs were free of blossom and subterfuge. I felt what I feel now, aligning these words. It is the same need to perfect, of which death is the mere byproduct. The poetics I have in mind is predicated on the reintegration of the arts into the humanities with the methodological help of the sciences. And by the way, in oral interpretation of literature, we have a lot of fun, too. One of the exercises that is the most successful is taking meters and putting together odd couples. It's amazing, for instance, if you take tetrameter, what will be housed under that if you take the sweep and span of poetical production. My favorite there is the fact that Stopping by the Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost scans to Hernando's Hideaway. I don't know if you've ever tried this, but it works beautifully. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow, with snow. The point of this work pedagogically and thematically is to challenge the mind-body dualism that is the bane of Western metaphysics, and I believe the bane of higher education in research and other research universities and other venues. Make that the root of a cause of dysfunction in society generally. Think of all that's at stake in maintaining mind-body dualism, led by the ferocious socioeconomic imperative to maintain the strict division of mental and manual labor on which all value is ultimately calculated. Confounding the mental and the manual, the corporeal and the intellectual, I propose to challenge the performing arts to start pulling their own weight in terms of research outcomes for the field and for their universities. The best way I know how to do that is by documenting my ideas by referencing the production and research activities of the World Performance Project, of which I've been the principal investigator for 6 years, and now its successor, the Interdisciplinary Performance Studies Program at Yale, which is a postdoctoral program. If you have any PhDs who are looking for work, I've got 4 2-year postdocs that I'm giving out. Although the World Performance Project works in all performance genres, including performance art, theater, and drama, I'm going to emphasize dance in my remarks. Our artistic director, Emily Coates, formerly of the New York City Ballet, and the companies of Mikhail Baryshnikov, Twyla Tharp, and Yvonne Rayner, is a principal contributor to the work. Although our productions have been drawn from all over the world, I will emphasize our African and African diasporic connections, which have been consistently a theoretical and practical touchstone for the work that we do. The key metaphor and practical performance technique of our research is polyrhythm, or cross-rhythm, which is simultaneously a musical and a kinesthetic structure. It is also a deeply cultural one, indebted to African and Afro-Caribbean performance, but now ambient, permeating our senses and preparing them for, among other things, the contemporary experience of cyber surfing across multiple media platforms. Kinesis, which means motion or change in Aristotle, is the root of kinescope, cinema, and kinetic, meaning active as opposed to latent and potential, and kinesthetic, which means the fine-grained quality of the movement. Our work is summed up in 3 propositions. Kinesis is the new mimesis. Polyrhythm mimics polyvocality, and polyvocality mimics hospitality. And a bit of an apologia here. I discovered in preparing my talk that I couldn't adequately load in my video clips into PowerPoint. I'm very interested in new media, but I'm a complete techno-klutz. So in this talk about moving bodies and kinesis, you're going to see still images. We were the first stop for Peru Negro and its first bus and truck tour of North America. The performance packed the house with Peruvian Americans and others. One family came to New Haven from Virginia and turned around and went back because they couldn't afford to stay in a hotel. And the audiences danced in the aisles and shouted back at the stage in Spanish. In addition to public workshops in dance technique and drumming, we followed up with a symposium called Intangible Cultural Heritage and the Global Performance Industry. Juan Murillo, artistic manager of Peru Negro, an international restaurateur with franchises in L.A. and Lima, joined Pamela McKean, who's vice president of booking of CAMI, that's Columbia Artist Management, Inc., the professional booker that was managing the company, the most efficient, ruthless, and well-known of management firms. And we had panels of experts, including Heidi Feldman, who writes on Rhythms of Peru, Reviving African Musical Heritage in the Black Pacific. This is the Black Pacific that is referenced here. And Jill Lane from Spanish and Portuguese at NYU, author of Blackface Cuba, and others, talking about the work, putting it in a context, and bringing the artists into conversation with the scholars. The symposium was invited to address the performance of Peru Negro in its Yale context from the perspective of the 2003 UNESCO Protocols for Intangible Cultural Heritage. Quote, "Those performing arts, oral expressions, social practices, rituals, festive events, knowledge and skills that communities recognize as part of their cultural heritage," end quote. Intangible heritage is the third of three parts of UNESCO's World Heritage Initiative. There's the tangible heritage initiative, which is buildings such as Angkor Wat and Robben Island, the prison there, and the slave forts at on the west coast of Africa. And then there's natural heritage, which is the usual suspects, the Amazon River Basin, the Galapagos Island complex, and the like. But the third, the most interesting for my purposes, for obvious reasons, intangible cultural heritage consists of performing arts, rituals, culinary arts, and masterpieces of oral expression, even though they are not written down, particularly because they are not written down. Dance forms, work so important that they belong not only to the people who create them, but to all humankind. And even languages themselves have been declared World Heritage Sites, worthy of preservations. Even the subjunctive within particular languages has been declared a World Heritage Initiative. I wish it were true that we had the subjunctive as an accurate part of English today. But not without friction. Not without friction. And here I cite Anna Singh's book called Friction, about how not so fast within a global context of moving people, moving bodies, moving corporate powers. She wants to look at where things are slowed down by a resistance and friction. Because the paradox of intangible cultural heritage resonates in what was its slogan for a time. It's since been removed from the website, but it was the slogan. And check this one out. Cultural diversity, a new universal ethic. It's sort of the Yogi Berra approach to cultural sloganeering. You know, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. The question we asked of the panelists included who owns culture and who benefits from its preservation. This was not a neutral issue at Yale at this moment, and consistent with our Orphic poetics, which requires looking back in order to move forward, we had to look back to Yale's tortured history with relationship to the people and the nation of Peru. The university was then at legal dagger points with the government of Peru over the ownership over the so-called treasures of Machu Picchu. The artifacts and human remains from the Incan mountaintop palace complex site crated up and sent back to New Haven by Hiram Bingham in 1911 to 1915. There they remained in the Peabody Museum on loan for purposes of study, until Peru wanted them back. Negotiations, which were promised would be ended triumphantly by the time Peru Negro arrived, had broken down in acrimony just before we hosted the event. And it wasn't helped by the concurrent release of Indiana Jones and the Mystery of the Crystal Skull. I don't know if anybody saw that, but it is shot on the Yale campus and is explicitly underscored in the most obnoxiously racist way possible with the link between Indiana Jones and Hiram Bingham as wanton pillagers of Andean cultural patrimony. This now has been settled and the stuff is all back in Peru, but at the time it was fractious. So the questions crackled in the air of the symposium. What does heritage mean and who owns it? Can it be shared? Can it be preserved without being commodified? Can it be bus and trucked, as we were doing with Peru Negro? How to negotiate the conflict in the world today between geographical mobility and cultural belonging? What does it mean for us to curate such a performance? Curate is now the term of art in performance studies when you host an event. And it always strikes me as a little bit perplexing since I associate it with the preservation of dead things. We posited that polyrhythm, the fabulous co-creation of world historical diaspora and creolization, established poetic conditions favorable to the production of polyvocality, different voices put together in the same room, which we offered as part of our hospitality to our guests, as indispensable to our project as food, almost as indispensable as drink. Peru Negro was one event in a repertoire of 40-plus similarly contextualized performances, collaborating with other departments in commissioning or booking scholarly and creative work in theater, dance, and performance art, and joining forces with the Yale Rep to produce a season called No Boundaries. I came to regret No Boundaries as a title. I'll get back to that in a minute. Never intended by WPP as ends in themselves, performances included Cuban-American stand-up comedy, installation art, slam poetry, readings in Arabic of plays in translation, which Margaret was involved in, Czech dance theater, Singaporean storytelling, and the like. Movement across distances, across time, across boundaries, is the key to everything we tried to do with the World Performance Project. And because dance is historically the least well-established of the performing arts at Yale, an administrator, when we started this, said dance was unworthy of Yale College as a curricular subject. It has also proved to be the least resistant to being moved. Movement in this sense means a transition into a research paradigm where production is not the endpoint of effort, but the provocation. This, we hope, is timely in world historic terms as well as local ones. Our working hypothesis about contemporary performance, kinesis is the new mimesis, is that the arts proliferate within the mediated and multicultural languages of transnational space. Expressive movement is becoming a lingua franca, the basis of a newly experienced affective cognition and corporeal empathy. Mimesis, rooted in drama, imitates action. Kinesis embodies it. In order to be what it can be, polyvocality, like justice, must be done, performed, actualized, and embodied. And what I want to do is a quick summary of some of the highlights of our offerings or representative ones to give the idea of this cross-rhythmic polyvocality, at least metaphorically, in our work. One of our soloists was Coco Fusco, A Room of One's Own, which I pulled a slide of for this presentation, particularly because we're marking the 10th anniversary of the War of Iraq. And Coco did this piece about the women involved in interrogation, in extraordinary rendition and enhanced interrogation techniques, to take the terms of art from that time, with the ironic citation of Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own as her touchstone. We brought Mark Bermudi Joseph's autobiographical hip-hop performance. We brought Veiled Monologues to much controversy. Veiled Monologues consists of explicit sexual ethnographies of Muslim women, as told by Muslim women, performed by Muslim women, filtered through a secular Dutch stage director turned ethnographer's view of what Muslim women are thinking and feeling. We brought Tim Crouch, a production called England, It's a site-specific drama about organ donation involving first world recipients and third world donors. And we collaborated with the med school, the Department of Bioethics, on this program. It's an amazing piece because it's written to be performed in an art museum. And ostensibly, in the early exposition, it's about moving valuable objects from place to place and changing their contexts. And in the unfolding drama, what is disclosed is that the objects being moved are living organs. We brought Witness to Ruins, which is by the Mapa Teatro of Bogota, Colombia. It's a piece about the raising of El Cartucho, which was a historic neighborhood in Bogota, considered a slum, even though it had beautiful colonial buildings in disrepair. And the government decided to raise it and cleaned out the neighborhood, about 6,000 people, dispossessed them of their homes, killed their pets, and gave them 2 weeks to vacate, and then flattened the whole neighborhood to make a park. And what this piece documented was the step-by-step displacement of the residents and the flattening of the neighborhood architecturally, while this video performance, a mediated performance, is going forward. There's the master chef from El Cartucho cooking a meal from the best restaurant that was raised, but she was there to cook for us. And after the performance, the meal is shared with the audience. So the whole room fills with the ambience of El Cartucho, even as you see it vanish before your eyes. We brought the Rude Mechanicals from Austin, Texas, and their production called The Method Gun. I don't know if anyone has seen it here. It's about a company of method actors turning homicidal after being in rehearsal for Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire and nothing else for 7 years. I don't want realism, I want magic. We brought Maria Jerez from Madrid, Spain, in The Case of the Spectator. Her video performance art is a murder mystery, which is performed by herself solo and 12 Barbie dolls that are dismembered in the performance. We commissioned a multimedia collaboration between Dean Moss, African-American choreographer, and Sungmun Chun, Korean sculptor and installation artist, and much else besides, including the North American premiere of Sklavi from the Farm in the Cave Studio Theater in Prague. I want to linger about this one for a minute because it surfaced a number of the issues that are pertinent to the research that I've promised to talk about. Based in Prague, the company derives movement and music theater scenarios from folk materials. The piece they brought us, Sklavi, the song of an immigrant, sets texts taken from letters sent back home by Czech nationals displaced by conditions of globalized labor, matching the haunted imagery of their words to old Ruthenian and Ukrainian songs, and adding a hyperkinetic corporeal score of sinuous movement, sometimes on the edge of abstraction, sometimes pantomimic, always evocative and frequently pointed. And it's here that the mimetic and the expressive, to me, are just fused in such a way that you cannot extricate them one from the other. Sklavi plays on the etymological connection between the word Slav and slave. But what does it mean in this context to declare that there are no boundaries? I told you that word was going to trouble me. We saw ourselves, guests as well as hosts, as falling in among the agents of globalization as well as its discontents, schlepping the folk material out of the Slovakian villages and onto the world stage. By using the phrase post-global performance, which was one that we coined for our work, we acknowledged with mixed feelings how unsurprising it had become to us that something as locally particular and intimately hard-won as a choreographic style can travel the planet with the celerity of luxury accessories and cheap labor. Looking back in order to move forward, we acknowledged that we are complicit in making diversity a new universal poetic, but not without a fight. The boundaries we denied in naming our season No Boundaries came back to haunt us, or more accurately, to bite us in stand-up tragedian Taylor Mack's one-man show, The Beast of Taylor Mack, which he tailored to riff on the absurdity of our fatuous attempt to brand our work No Boundaries. Well, Under the Radar had been taken. The Next Wave had been taken. We had to come up with something. And Taylor really nailed us. He shrieked to the delight of the packed crowd, focusing right on me. I was in the front row. "I don't know about you people here at Yale, but I, Taylor Mack, have boundaries." But we can give as good as we get. Tavia Nyong'o of NYU Performance Studies came back at Taylor in the symposium face-to-face. Taylor started in village living rooms and now plays at regional reps. I bet she's played at the Huntington. Tavia titled his symposium talk, "The Gentrification of Freakishness." We built a website where our work could be posted, and for anyone interested, all of our work, including video documentation of everything, will be in the Beinecke online, so anyone can access it. And as part of our contract, the artist had to sign off on using the work for scholarly research, so you don't need to go through the usual process of permissions. You can't show the whole thing, just fair use clips. The most ambitious project that we attempted was the Festival of International Dance, 5 works from 3 choreographers, 3 North American, and 1 world premiere. In conjunction with the idea that kinesis is the new mimesis, we believed that the human body cannot be wholly abstracted, bidden or unbidden. It will signify. To move your body is to tell your story, and the older you get, the more stories your body tells. We brought 3 choreographers together for a week of performances, workshops, talkbacks, and symposia. Yasmin Goder, an Israeli trained at NYU, Opio Okach, a Kenyan who works in Nairobi and Paris, and Yvonne Rayner, a major figure in the Judson Dance Theater in the day, a focal point of the downtown scene in the 1960s, and now coming back after a career in film, back to choreography as an older woman, is telling stories in a quite extraordinary way. We provided hospitality in the enlarged sense I am proposing here, as in polyvocality, tending the kinesthetic needs and desires of our guests, and they to one another's. In the course of their mutual explorations, they discovered deep connections as well as deep differences in their works and beliefs about their works. First off, singular sensation looked anything but hospitable, and seemed polyvocal only in its sense of a complete cacophony. Emily Coates wrote about this piece. Singular sensation eventually erupts into dark Dionysian chaos, slipping and sliding around in substances which included dried spaghetti, red jello, and green paint. The dancers alternate between moving in solidarity and beating each other up. Reaching energetic levels far outside the realm of pedestrian, her dancers lash out and recoil, inflate and deflate, slide toward each other and scurry away. Physically distressed by the end, their trauma seems real, end quote. In conversation with Yvonne, Yasmin recalled the minimalist impact of the residual Judson Dance Theater from her years at NYU. But in the talkback, all of our performances include talkbacks, our audiences, marking Yasmin's Israeli identity, wanted to read the choreography of Singular Sensation as an allegory of Israeli-Palestinian relationships, and why wouldn't they? Locked in a bitter embrace of enmity and destructive violence. Yasmin just smiled and would neither confirm nor deny. On reflection, someone counterproposed that Singular Sensation might rather be an allegory of male-female relationships locked in a bitter embrace of enmity and destructive violence. Kinesis is the new mimesis because it is a particularly powerful kind of mimetic process, the kind that imitates not only an action, but an idea, an emotion, even an inchoate impulse, but a structure of relations as well. moving angrily away from each other as if to escape their erotic fates. The dancers in singular sensation were snapped back together by shredded pantyhose that tethered them together, plighting their miserable troths. Less for better, more for the worse, till death cuts the rayon threads, sending the male dancers sprawling across the stage. At this suggestion that it was male-female animosity, not Israel-Palestinian animosity, Yasmin laughed out loud and slugged her boyfriend so hard on the arm that he fell out of his chair. Kinesis is the new mimesis. Opio Okach brought us two North American premieres, Border Border Express and Now. Border Border Express and No Man's Gone Now, what you see here. It is a collaboration with Julian Hamilton, the British-based choreographer based in London. The voiceover narration of No Man's Gone is about place, ostensibly Kenya, which slowly, subtly, but unmistakably undoes the Western cliches about East Africa that resonate in our eyes and ears from Meryl Streep's performance in Out of Africa. I had a farm in Africa, etc. Opio sends up nostalgia without memory by proving nostalgia just isn't what it used to be. Opio lives a more cosmopolitan reality, which he danced even more explicitly in the second piece of the festival, Border Border Express. In Opio's cross-rhythmic virtuosity, we found a very important kinesthetic genealogy. Opio's moves combine some East African motives with others that were recognizably American postmodern from the heady days of Judson Church. Yvonne Rayner, key progenitor of postmodern dance at Judson Church, gasped out loud when she recognized the movement style of her erstwhile colleague Steve Paxton in Flat and Backwater Twosome from the 1970s, especially in Opio's focused, calm, deliberate movement with a straight spine. We learned, to our dance historian's delight, but not to our total surprise, that Julian Hamilton, Opio's London collaborator, studied with Steve Paxton, and he is known as the Steve Paxton of Britain. And what form was communicated over the decades and three continents in the medium of muscle and bone? Precisely this. There is a line, a certain line. None could be more rigorous. What is this line? It is the line Opio is making with his body. No, not with his body alone. There's that duality again. Except as the instrument, the stylus, the line he is making with his mind-body by balancing his entire idea on the ball of one foot. No, it is not his mind-body alone, but an arabesque that began in Steve Paxton's toes in New York and arrived in Opio's torso in Nairobi, having passed through Julian Hamilton's pelvis in London. And what do we see arriving over time and space in the mobile chiaroscuro of this most hospitable body? First, that the certain line stands still, vertically, pivoting slowly to clarify its heart-stopping shape in the light and astonished air. Then, miraculously, Opio makes the line move back and forth across the stage, but without it ever breaking, without it ever severing the intimate lover's bond between his idea, their idea, and our held breaths, curving, rippling, bending, extending, but never breaking, a mirage, a wave, a flame. We sponsored Yvonne Rayner's ROS Indexical, a truly delicious send-up of the pseudo-ethnography of Rite of Spring, and commissioned Spiraling Down, which had its world premiere in New Haven, in collaboration with our Los Angeles partners, the Getty Museum and the Red Cat Theater at the Roy and Edna Disney Center. I won't describe these dances, but simply say that it is our contention that the artistic value of the creative work and the research outcomes are interdependent. The World Performance Project, along with our Los Angeles partners, was recognized by the award for best performance for the premiere of ROS Indexical and Spiraling Down by the International Art Critics Association, sponsored by UNESCO. And what of the research outcomes? Like the companies we book, we write together as we make dance theater work together, collectively, collaboratively, experimentally, and polyvocally. We need to change the way in which performance scholarship is created, published, and evaluated by doing that. To that end, we have already moved beyond the single author model of traditional humanistic scholarship. Ultimately, all of us who participate in the project sign the article and share the credit as well as the labor of producing it. Adam Horowitz and Amy Rosenblum, the Yale College undergraduate oral historians for World Performance Project, documented the background to their work and ours over the life of the Mellon Grant. We are making this material available even as we continue to mine it ourselves for future publication, making an archive out of our repertoire and vice versa. And now we come to Don't Look Back, which is what I promised you would be the finale. And I just want to riff on the idea of putting it all together. This was an undergraduate production of an original musical, really a danceical, in which we used the popular form of Tina Ramen at dance parties of the 1950s, like Dick Clark's American Bandstand, to retell the story of the civil rights movement in the spring of 2008, even as Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were neck and neck in the primaries. And it was fascinating to work kinesthetically on this by reviving the dances of the 1960s with students who are steeped in the contemporary idioms of postmodern, post-global dance. And it was fascinating to be the only one in the room with a living memory of the twist, trying to explain what we thought we were doing on the dance floor in those days of yours to students who were so far beyond this. What is it I done told you? Well, Kinesis is the new mimesis, and here's Don't Look Back, mediatized, but all live and all dance. And here are some of the more somber moments with the Orpheus and Eurydice couples. There were three couples. Two of them looked back and went back, and one of them didn't look back and went forward. Thinking about hospitality and polyvocality, the other key terms. Here's one of our pieces that went badly wrong. Somebody, I won't confess who it was, thought it would be a great idea to try out one of our dance pieces between Lasso Koulibaly from Burkina Faso and Emily Coates, our ballerina, fusing the Balanchine aesthetic with West African dance and to try it out in Grand Central Station. And as you see in the lower slide, officers O'Reilly and Finelli didn't embrace our aesthetic of polyvocality, and we were seriously busted. Thank you very much.
Well, among the many wonderful things you said, I was struck by your use of the word nostalgia a couple of times. And also when you said that you had a sentimental attachment still to liveness. And I heard in sentimental and nostalgia maybe a little friction in your own thinking about your own work. And I was just wondering how you related this project to your earlier work. I'm a big admirer of Cities of the Dead, and also what you're doing moving forward.
Oh, thank you. That's a wonderful question to be able to have the privilege to answer. That friction, that kind of uneasiness that you heard in that is complex. And one of the main features of my nervousness around this is performance studies, this field that we've been talking about, is becoming by the day ever more presentist and is less welcoming to historians, not because there's a purge, it's just because the pressure of the excitement of this moment in performance focuses on the present without, in my view, taking sufficient account of what has gone before, which I see in genealogies of performance in the work in the present. Hence, an example such as the Steve Paxton to Julian Hamilton, to Opiel Koch, genealogy. And of course, my other hat, I make my living, my day job is as English literature and 18th century especially. My view is that the 18th century just hasn't ended yet. It isn't over, right, yeah. The Second Amendment I cite as example of this this unending 18th century that I call the deep 18th century, as opposed to the long 18th century and the wide 18th century. The deep 18th century is the one that isn't over yet. And I want to hang on to that. I want to hang on to that historian's approach, to the literary approach, to the textual approach in performance studies. And that's increasingly difficult as the field develops and as younger people are less interested in the twist than they might have been even 10 or 15 years ago. And I'm finding the pressure by doctoral students to move ever more contemporary and to think of history. You know, we're going to do an archival research in 1969. Well, yes, yeah, that can be done, and it's certainly a part of history, but I'm still sentimentally attached to 1769 and trying to keep that just as exciting as the work on present topics. Thank you very much. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Yale University Sterling Professor of Theater and English, Joseph Roach. Professor Roach's lecture was titled New Poetics, Performance Studies and the Research University, and was presented by the Boston University Humanities Foundation, co-sponsored by the Departments of English, Romance Studies, and Modern Languages and Comparative Literature. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Associate Professor Carrie Preston. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Tota and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.